Hey, Emmanuel Hayford here, and I want to tell you about AppSignal. AppSignal is a no-brainer monitoring for smart developers that allows you to track errors and performance in your applications. With AppSignal, you get beautiful dashboards that provide deep insights to quickly get to the root cause of problems. It's easy to set up, and with real human support, you'll be ready to track and crash bugs within minutes after installation. Check AppSignal out at appsignal.com. That's appsignal.com. Android learned Rails in 2004 and in 2005 deployed his first Rails production application. In 2007, he founded Arkansy, which now specializes in rescuing big Rails applications. He loves programming and learning new paradigms. Android is also a chess player, aiming to one day become an international master. Welcome to the Rails Changelog, Android.
Hello, Emmanuel, and hello, everyone, and thanks for the invitation.
I've seen you championing a cause in the Ruby on Rails community, and the cause that I'm talking about is generally DDD, which is domain-driven design. I've had like lots of terms around this idea, this paradigm, but before we start our conversation, I would like to know about some specific terms that you use inside of around this paradigm. One of such terms is event sourcing and an event-driven architecture. First of all, what's event sourcing in the first place?
Event sourcing is a different kind of persistence than typical, let's say, as we are used to with Active Record. We are mapping objects into records, and we are persisting the last state of the record usually. With event sourcing, we persist all deleted changes that happen to a specific object. We group those events into a stream which belongs to this object, and that's the biggest difference. So event sourcing, as per definition, is just a persistence mechanism, which many people confuse with event-driven architecture. So I'm glad you make this distinction immediately. Event-driven architecture is the bigger thing, or at least more impactful, I would say, because that's building your software in a way that you have modules communicating via events, which allows to some decoupling between modules. So you could say that callbacks in Rails are kind of this direction, but not exactly. But event is a data structure which represents what has happened. So it can be used for communication. There are many kinds of events, by the way. It can be also used for persistence. So then it becomes part of the event sourcing.
Right. It's all cool to hear about these things, but how do these ideas or concepts relate to domain-driven design in particular?
Domain-driven design, the biggest concept is the idea of splitting your whole system into contexts, or from the business world, we would call them domains. So in, let's say, e-commerce projects, you would have pricing, inventory, ordering. So those big like department names, I even sometimes call it departments. And then with events, you can communicate between those departments. So let's say pricing can say, hey, my product, which is with this ID, has now this price because someone changed the price. And maybe invoicing is interested in this, right? Because invoicing is this module where you generate an invoice. So they might be actually very interested in changes in the prices. Mm-hmm. Similarly with, let's say, customer changes the address, and address becomes part of the delivery bounded context or context. So you communicate this change, and this event is like a pop up. You are thinking about this like you're publishing this, and another context subscribes to this and consumes this event and does something with this. So this is like where the domain-driven design connects with events.
Yeah, and I noticed a new term popped up, which I have no idea what it is. And you mentioned something like a bounded context. What does it mean to say something is bounded or a context is bounded?
Yeah, context is bounded where it has a clear boundaries. So for example, with this inventory, you would like to encapsulate all the inventory related stuff inside this context. But let's say inventory probably in a good design shouldn't need to, let's say, grab prices from the pricing thing. So this is like, let's say, clear boundaries. We are talking about inventory-related terminology here. In pricing, we are talking about prices, all the things that are about prices, offers, and so on. While inventory is about, you know, storing some quantities, maybe some packages even or something like this, but not about prices. We don't care about prices in inventory. So bounded contexts mean that we create some boundaries around certain contexts. It's also just to, I understand that this might be confusing with this terminology. Context is a technical term, so that's what we programmers create, while domains or subdomains is the business concept. So sometimes it's a one-to-one mapping, so inventory is a business concept. It maps to a bounded context called inventory, and you can, in Ruby, you can think it's just a module called inventory. While sometimes, for some reason, let's say an e-commerce application, maybe ordering and inventory, they go together and they create one context while being two domains. So there is a coupling, but this coupling may be actually useful, because then in order you can easily grab what is the, if this item is available in the inventory, let's say. So some people choose this kind of design.
Right. And if we're talking about domain-driven design, is it something that we can fully apply to Ruby on Rails applications today? And if so, can you give me like a good reason or a good opportunity where one would decide to go for domain-driven design or an event-driven architecture? Like if I have a monolith, for instance, what are some of the signs that I should look out for that would tell me like, hey, it's time to change your way of thinking and it's time to apply domain-driven design to your application?
It's a story of my life, of my programming life, like how I connected Ruby on Rails and domain-driven design, or we connected at RKNC. We had a really interesting evolutionary, let's say, research what to do with big Rails applications. Because when we started doing Rails, I started quite early in 2004. In 2005, I've had my first Rails project. I noticed after some 2-3 years that there are no longer only greenfield projects, but also this big existing Rails projects. Because Rails applications, when they grow and they follow the same patterns all the time, they end up with big classes, big active record classes. This is a very usual situation. I think every single project I have seen, and I've seen hundreds of them, always suffers from this big user class, big order class, or whatever is the main God class in active record. And I think this is where the problem lies, like where you would like to find some solution to the problem that in Rails applications, via associations in active record, you can get from one place to every other place in the system, basically. So this design is very coupled, and which brings a risk that you are changing one place and you are not super confident that maybe you are not breaking some other parts in another system. So if you see that your project becomes this kind of fragile in this meaning, that you're changing one place and somehow magically another place changes and maybe breaks, maybe there's a regression, then probably you want to find some solution. And there were many attempts in the Ruby on Rails community for over the years how to solve this problem. DHH says, concerns are the solution to, at least part of the solution to this problem. Other people tried different approaches. There was a moment in the community that service objects became popular. They slightly, improved the situation because they took some logics from the active record to the service layer. But still, if you look at the big, really big Rails applications, and I mean like by really big, like over 150 active record models and stuff like this, this still doesn't improve the complexity. People are still worried to change anything. It's hard to actually test something in isolation. So you will look for some modularization. That's usually what people try to find, some modules. And when you try to find some modules, you can also go in different directions. But sooner or later, you will probably find that maybe modules according to how business defines them might make some sense. And this is what domain-driven design is about. So basically, it's about reflecting the business, the strategic business design into programming design. So let's say we, in e-commerce, we just use very typical term, and many business people would use inventory, pricing, all the related stuff. That's natural terms for them. And if you have such modules in your application, and those modules are kind of separated from each other, you can actually try to communicate with the business how your design works. Because otherwise, if you show them that, you know, you don't really have a separated inventory part, or maybe there is inventory, but actually it's not really bounded, so you can get from inventory easily to pricing and so on, the business people, they might be okay with this, they might accept it, but in reality, how they structure their business, it's, you know, it's not easy, not usually that the marketing department goes to the inventory, grab their papers easily and just bring them to their own room. That's usually not how it works. Things are structured, things are surrounded by business processes. And that's the second part of domain-driven design. So I said about context and the whole mapping of domains. So that's one place. And my favorite other second technique, and very important, is building processes. We call them process managers in domain-driven design. And those are objects which are responsible for this high-level, long-running business processes. Let's say an order is a long-running business process. You can start an order today and finish it 1 week later. And if you even, you know, consider delivery as part of ordering, which it is, then actually this whole business process takes sometimes 1 month, let's say. Mm-hmm. So you have an object which listens to certain events from many different departments, like whether it's delivered, whether this client paid, whether there is such a client, and whether we actually handle this client, whether it's not banned or something. Mm-hmm. So you can have a process which encapsulates just moving from one step of the process to another step of the process. So it's like a state machine. And if you see big Rails application with big active record classes, inside this active record classes, you will see usually certain state machines, usually more than one. Usually those active records are like, sometimes the bigger one has like, are like 50 columns in the database. So usually it's very mixed concept. So the user has a concept of password, but the user has also a concept of a client name or a client address or delivery address. So it's all in one place. So the active record is basically totally the opposite. If you follow the active record fully with the design, like with Ruby on Rails, too far, and you will end up kind of opposite of what is domain-driven design, because it's like an orthogonal architecture. So we try to put everything user-related to one place. Domain-driven design says, no, put this department ideas in one place. So inventory, invoicing, pricing, and so on, this should belong to different places. So that's how it connects. In general, it can be applied. This is what our company usually does. We usually help with big Rails projects, and we apply not all of the techniques because it's kind of impossible in a finite time, but at least some of them to make some separation. We introduce events, and we introduce the communication between those modules using events. Sometimes we introduce event sourcing, but it's actually not always the case. And this is just persistence mechanism. I even built a sample project if someone is interested. There is a RKNC e-commerce project. That's why I mentioned e-commerce so much, because I built a sample project which is using Ruby on Rails, definitely. And it's using domain-driven design. It's using event sourcing. It's using event-driven architecture. So it's still not trivial, but also not like super complex. So we can probably follow the patterns there. Mm-hmm. And I built it because I really wanted to show like, okay, look at this project, because if you like what you see, this the separation, the modularization, then maybe this is a good idea for you to explore domain-driven design, because it's quite a long process of learning. But if you don't like it, maybe this is too much abstraction for you, you don't like this kind of layer separation and so on, then okay, at least you save some learning. That's not exactly for you.
Yeah, I think you showcased this app on YouTube some time ago. I'm not sure if it's the same app that you're talking about, but I think I've seen it somewhere on YouTube. I liked it, but one thing I also noticed that like this concept is particularly useful to a certain group of applications. One thing I noticed particularly about this concept is that you mostly or at least in some of your examples, you mostly applied it to applications around the e-commerce field or applications that like have a lot of transactions, financial transactions. I mean, is there a specific type of application that you know for a fact that DDD or splitting things into bounded context, is that what you call it, won't work? Mm-hmm. Are there certain types of applications that this kind of thinking or approach wouldn't be worthwhile?
Of course, when there are this type of application, but it's rarely to build, let's say, a Rails application where chat is the main most important feature. So all the real-time stuff, of course, is actually very often built with event-driven design, but it's less about complexity at the business perspective. It's more about, let's say, optimization or performance or concurrency. But people usually they wouldn't use Ruby on Rails for that too much. But everything that kind of maps to some business, I think it helps, because we can reduce this question to a dilemma if we should map the business to the code, at least at the strategic level, so the departments, let's say. Because if there is something like this, then that's easy answer for me. Okay, let's say some people build some simple web games, for example. But even these web games, you can split it into, there is a concept like the context of a board. There is a concept of, let's say, mechanics of the rules. And there is a context of, let's say, what kind of world abstraction does it represent. So there's still some potential split, and I actually built such things with domain-driven design. I think it's more about the technical approach, whether people like it or not. That's would be the, like, if there's one person who wants to introduce domain-driven design into a Rails application, but there's six other people who have no idea about domain-driven design and they're actually skeptical, then it's, of course, asking for a disaster at the human level. But at the technical level, at the architecture level, I think in terms of departments now. So it's, for me, it's natural, but I can understand that, of course, it's not so clear for everyone. We use domain-driven design in a ticketing platform, which, okay, is kind of like e-commerce. We use it in an educational platform, so a typical, you know, courses platform. I actually now switched from this e-commerce part to build a to-do application. So I want this family of to-do applications like Todoist or Nozbe, or bigger product management applications like Trello or Jira. I want to build a similar sample application which would show that this they actually have very interesting contexts. Like, for example, calendar is a context in such to-do applications, or project is a concept, while the simplest context is usually tasks. So that's the basic core of this domain. But even this domain, even this kind of project, I thought maybe this would be a challenge to find some departments, let's say. But no, if you dig a little bit more, if you do some analysis in your mind, in your head. By the way, there is a technique called event storming, where you put events as sticky notes on the wall. Many people love it because you bring business people together with programmers. If you are happy to have them in the same room, or you just virtually use Miro as a board and then use those events. It's a fantastic tool, actually, by the way. Many people actually love it, how you see the flow of the business on a wall together. Like, I have moderated such sessions. It's usually like 1-2 hours and very visualizing, very opening, you know, people's minds, like what's the system is about. So yeah, I think like I can't really easily come with a project that wouldn't work, but it's more about me being used to and me being experienced in this way. I can totally imagine people not thinking this way.
Right. And earlier you mentioned stuff about like DDD wouldn't particularly be beneficial to real-time processing. And I wanted to ask, like, speaking of real-time processing, how does event sourcing in Rails impact database transactions, especially in applications requiring high levels of data integrity and real-time processing?
Yeah, there is nothing like that could be disturbing the transactions. So that by the way, that's the reason we've built Rails Event Store. So that's a tool that you can easily use in your Rails application. And what it does, this tool at the beginning, it creates you some data tables, I think two or three of them, and it creates a table called events and a table called events in streams. So this way you have all the events in your database, and it's in the same database as you use for your Rails application. So in general, whatever you do as part of the same database transaction, you are, let's say, saving the user record as you would usually do, but now you're also want to use event-driven plus event sourcing, and you say user login changed, and this is an event. So this event will be saved to the events table, but it's part of the same transaction. It's part of the same database transaction, so the integrity is easily secured. Of course, but that's the same case as with Rails and application with Rails, which runs some background jobs. Of course, they have different, they use different database connections. You cannot have the same transaction. So, of course, that's very the same challenge, like what to do if this background job fails. Now you need to make sure that this data is consistent. And so at this level, it's very the same. So there is no like new risk introduced. Actually, there are some patterns once you use events, which at the business level, they help you, let's say, manage business transactions. So, for example, this process manager is kind of like a big transaction, while not being a really database transaction. It's just making sure that some steps are possible or not. And there's also a concept of Saga. Saga is kind of like a process, but it's a reversible process. So the classic example is when you book a travel, a hotel, flight, and a car, and you want them all to work. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense for you to travel. So if you have flight and car, but you didn't book hotel, this is not a perfect situation for you. So it's easy to listen to events, and let's say you have event like car booking succeeded, flight succeeded, but you have an event saying hotel booking failed. And then you react to this event at the business level exactly as the business would tell you, and they would tell you, well, now we actually need to cancel our flight and cancel our car. So now you will issue, we have events and there are commands. So you issue a new command to the system, to the, let's say, flight system, and you say, sorry, cancel this flight for me. Like, could you please cancel this? And they will, of course, also they will either respond at the end of the process with either flight cancellation succeeded or flight cancellation failed. And then you again decide at the business level, okay, what do we do in such case? We couldn't cancel the flight. But at least now you have this under control, because now you have the events which always represent what is happening. We have events for representing all kinds of situations, happy situations, but also unsuccessful ones. So then you can easily, having this, because it's not so easy, let's say, without events, it's not so easy to have in one place a situation that you manage to handle, to really book hotel and book the flight and the car but not hotel. It's less, let's say, easy to capture this situation. With events, it's like a first class citizen. You have very often you have objects which are responsible for reacting to certain events and then proceeding with a new command. Those will be the processes that we mentioned before. And about the data integrity and even sourcing as a persistence mechanism, it's just loading a list of events. So for a user, you would have, let's say, 15 events. So you load them from the database, you would replay them to create the user object, which is event sourced now. And then when you apply some changes to the user objects, it first saves the event to the database, then it publishes it. And it's all part of one transaction always, right? So then that becomes the 16th event of this user object. And the whole art of dealing with event sourcing is to always think about the smallest object that can possibly be, which is always a good idea to design smaller objects. But in event sourcing, it's especially important because you don't want to have hundreds or thousands of events required to build a certain object. So you really want to have small objects. So instead of big user class, you will have the customer part of this class in the CRM. You will have this address, delivery address in the delivery system. So this is how nicely domain-driven design solves the problem of event sourcing, maybe having too many events for one object, because your object is too big and your object can be split into, let's say, many departments. And then you have many tiny objects. Each of them can be event source, doesn't have to be. They communicate via events and they are built from the events.
Yeah. And speaking of sagas, I think I learned about sagas from Robert Pankowski's talk in like a long time ago in his Wroclaw RB talk, which we'll get back to in a bit. But what are some techniques for migrating an existing Rails app to an event-driven architecture? And what are the common pitfalls and success factors during such migrations?
I really like starting by, of course, understanding the business. That, you know, assuming your team already understands the business very well, then it's actually quite easy. But what I like to map at the beginning is the departments. And this is really easy. You will quickly recognize what are the departments because you don't invent departments. They're usually very classical business names for this. It's very rare that you would work on a project that doesn't have, say, sales department or sales module or pricing module. If you sell something, you always have a price. If you allow people to order stuff, you will have ordering departments. So those departments are very, very typical. There's like, let's say, 100 of typical domains you can just choose. Okay, I have those. So that's the first part. And this is a static structure. And then there's this dynamic structure, which is finding business processes which are crossing those departments. So we split the company into departments, but the idea is that then we want to allow them to be specialists in their departments, but they need to collaborate. We need to have a collaboration between departments. So this collaboration can be done by appropriate process managers or sagas. Technically, they are the same because they respond to events and they issue new commands. Mm-hmm. So it's good to think, what are your processes, like high-level processes in your system? And in, let's say, educational platform, completing a course by a student sounds like a big process. And it's probably a good candidate for having student completion or student course completion object, which would be a process. So once you start, like, what is also your processes, it will be easy for you to see, okay, because the processes, they kind of live above the departments. They are like rules. This is how the departments collaborate. So in a business perspective, this is how you define how is the cooperation between the departments. Another way of starting will be by a concept that we didn't mention, but I think it might be a good moment to introduce it. It's because it very often goes together, at least nowadays, with the modern domain-driven design. By the way, this is the blue book. It's a domain-driven design book by Eric Evans. This is the classical.
I cannot see it. Is it the one above your head? Can you pick it up?
So this is domain-driven design book by Eric Evans, and this is like the most classical book. But this is also from 2004, and if you read this, actually many things are a bit dated, but still very smart. Because in this domain-driven design book, you can learn a lot about mapping domains, context. There's a lot about processes, but they didn't use the concept of events. So you will kind of lack it, which I think is very unfortunate, but okay, it still makes sense without events. But if you have events, you can do quite a lot of things. And in 2010, 2011, and there was this guy called Greg Young, very smart guy, programmer who explored some old concept of command query separation. It was called CQS, but he kind of connected this with events and with domain-driven design a little bit. And he came up with an extension to this concept called CQRS, so command query responsibility segregation. And CQRS at the highest level, to just have some basic understanding, is a concept of splitting some parts of your system into reads and writes. And this is not very intuitive at the beginning, because especially for Rails programmers, we are used to think about, you know, user class, we are used to think about CRUD. So of course, CRUD is both create and read, right? By definition, we mix those things together. And what Greg introduced to the community is amazing, because he showed, well, you don't only split the departments at the business level, but by the way, you can actually separate reads as something else. So if you look at your application, Rails application, very often you have a report which kind of shows all the data from your system. So there are users, projects, orders, everything together. Usually those reads are very slow because they're joined many tables to display. So many people deal with some caches. They will find some techniques to make them faster. So very often in many projects, there is such place, which is a challenge. Maybe this report needs to be generated overnight. Maybe it takes 12 hours. I've seen such situations. And basically what CQRS introduces is that, hey, we can actually separate reads from writes. And then you will notice how much stuff disappears from your business objects, from your, let's say, user class. And if you look at the user class, even associations are very often useful because they are useful for showing data. They're very useful for displaying. Amazing, actually. Active Record is amazing for displaying data. It's so handy. I never found a better library for this. So in the parts of the system where we want to display data, Active Record is amazing. But in those parts where we want to, let's say, run business processes, have some business objects, some departments, some domains, and so on, you actually can do this without Active Record because you can use event sourcing in this part. So in general, you would use event sourcing for those business objects, but the reads, you can do a mix of, let's say, event sourcing and caches. If you connect event sourcing with caches, usually caches have this classical problem of when to revalidate a cache, right? This is the famous saying that this is one of the most difficult things in computer science. So you can introduce a concept of read models. A read model is like a connection of events and cache. Basically, you want to say, hey, I will always persist in the data table, actual relational data table, and the last state of this report, let's say. Of course, it doesn't need to always work this way, but it can be. And then whenever something changes that has an impact on this view, it will publish an event. And then this view, we call them read models, those read models will consume this event and they will say, oh, a price changed. Let me see. I probably need to, let's say, regenerate some rows in my report, maybe. Because maybe you're reporting that actually price changed one day before because you forgot about it. And now you have to, you know, revalidate the cache, let's say. So you would just regenerate this read model. I would say just, of course, performance-wise, it's a maybe bigger issue. But the concept is that now you will have Active Record classes specific for one view area in your application. So that's a new, let's say, technique in your toolbox to split your Active Record classes into smaller pieces. And then it's actually, some people would say that, okay, this is splitting too much, but then it actually really fits very well. You will have a different user class to display user on the panel admin, and maybe you will have a different user class for, let's say, displaying the profile for this user when they are logged in, because maybe you're showing different data, and maybe this data is like completely in a different perspective presented. And it doesn't matter if it's using Rails views, or there's a single page application with an API, or maybe you're using Hotwire. By the way, Hotwire works really amazing with events. We've done this in our projects, and this is that was the kind of missing puzzle for us also, because it solved so many front-end issues. So we are now happy to be back with Rails views, you know, server-rendered views, as in the old days. And then we communicate with events to those Active Record, Hotwire, or Turbo-enhanced Active Record classes, and they will handle all the, you know, refreshing on the views. That's super amazing. On our RKNC blog, if you find it interesting, you can see some blog posts about it with some diagrams and some code how we did it. This is really, really amazing. So to summarize, you know, you have business part of your application being just about changing the states and publishing events about it. All the code that was responsible for showing data disappears, which, by the way, again, is a good concept in OOP, that OOP shouldn't expose too much data with your getters or some kind of methods which query the object. That was always a mystery to me. That was like a long, really long journey for me. Like how can I make objects not exposing data when I really want to show this data at some level, right? So how do I do it? And if you imagine that this object publishes data via events, you have the cake and you eat the cake. So you have objects which, okay, they publish the event with some partial data, but they never expose their internal state in other ways, because the views will only consume the data from the events, and they will, the read models will consume this data, they will persist it, and they will show it to the user. And this is a really nice separation. At least for me, this was really like a breakthrough in my thinking when I remember it. I don't know, it was 2012, I think, when I met Mirek, who now is part of Arkansas. But he was actually a .NET programmer. And once he explained to me, like how the puzzles connect the events, domain-driven design, and the read models, it was like, you know, this aha moment in my life. It was like sitting over a beer and writing some diagrams on a napkin. And, you know, we didn't invent it. Mirek didn't invent it. He just followed Greg Young, you know, lessons very well. By the way, immediately after that, I hired Mirek to Arkansas, and he's till today at Arkansas. And he helped us understand and connect the different terms that we knew. We knew something about event sourcing, but as many people, for example, I have this really bad assumptions that event sourcing is about restoring the whole system state from events. And I always thought, like, who would be such a crazy person to load all the events? It must be slow and so on. But okay, if you are thinking about business objects, and business objects are separated per department, per domain, then they are tiny objects. So event sourcing actually makes sense. It's not a performance issue. There is no problem with the data integrity, no problem with transactions consistency, and so on. So that was amazing that all this thing clicked together. And I think the split between the reads and writes, this was the last puzzle for me. And once I got it, it was a pleasure to create projects since then, because I kind of solved my lifelong problems about object-oriented design.
Yeah, I have a few questions, and I'm terrified, or should I say, I'm afraid I'm going to forget them. So I'll ask them before we move on to the next question. And that question was, like, when you were talking about sagas, it sounded to me like the idea of sagas is basically trying to treat every interaction as a transaction. So it's either everything goes through or none of them at all. Will I be right in thinking this way?
I mean, sagas are designed to solve the problem when you want it. So when you want this kind of process, which should either run all the operations or none of them, because this is a business, important business concept for you, then saga is a good solution for that. In practice, you don't use sagas that much. It's not really like you always need to revert, you know, some business processes. Let's say a user completes a course or they don't complete the course. Well, okay, they don't complete the course. You don't need to reverse some big business part about it. But let's say if you have refunding an order, this might be kind of like a saga, because then you need this. And let's say you delivered the project to the, delivered the items to the client, and they somehow they canceled the order and they need a refund. So now you actually need to roll back. You need to roll back at the business level, not at the database level. You need to first, let's say, send them back the money. Then you need to handle, okay, we will send you the courier, the transportation to get this item back from you. Let's say this was an expensive item. So you will have some certain business operations to do it. But usually those, again, saga is like a specific kind of process manager. You use them when you want to do everything at once or revert. But usually you would build normal processes, normal process managers, which are not about reverting. They don't care that much about running everything or nothing. They basically react about, okay, it seems like we can go to another state of our course completion, or about order completion, or about order delivery. So that's sometimes you need it, but very often it's not saga.
Right. And the other thing that I wanted to ask is, like, throughout your explanations and descriptions, you mentioned something about separating reads from writes. How different or how beneficial would this be compared to, like, if we had to go the Rails way? For some time now, Rails has supported multiple databases at the same time, so you could set one database for your reads and one for your writes specifically just for that. How beneficial would applying this paradigm be compared to the Rails way of doing things?
I think the Rails, the part of Rails which I love, is about displaying data. So exactly Using Active Record and using all the new features. It's amazing how the core team works on the new features, how, you know, often we get new things. So multiple databases is of course an amazing feature to have. I have to admit I never used it in practice yet. There was a project I remember in the past where we kind of thought, oh well, it would be nice to have this, but we don't. It can be nicely combined with the read models, because let's say we can have a different database for read models for the admin panel, different database for the read models for the user facing application. So I can see it work. To be honest, I try to usually keep things simple as long as I can in terms of infrastructure. So if one database, my favorite Postgres, works well, then I'm quite happy to, you know, keep it in one database, because there is, like, let's say, logical separation. So one read model is usually one database table. Sometimes it's more, but you can easily prefix them so that they are easily separated by naming, or you can use Postgres schemas if you really want to separate something harder. So yeah, that's what I do. You can combine it easily because the read models, and this is actually okay, where we can enter some more risky scenarios. You can go asynchronous with building certain things from events. Let's say read models, they can be done in background jobs. So the same issues that we have with Rails in background jobs. So no transactions, things can fail. What do we do? Do we replay? What do we exactly do with this job? So this is a asynchronous approach. And now, of course, you are risking inconsistent states. So now it's up to you what to do. So many read models, they can be reacting to events in background jobs. And the nice thing about background jobs and the way they are solved in Rails with Sidekick and stuff, it's again amazing. It's basically you can easily detect that something bad happened. You can replay it, rerun the job, which will replay the event to this read model. It's very easy to be idempotent. You know that this event was either, you know, already consumed or not. So you will, if it's important, you will never consume the same event twice. And that's a very easy thing to do with combining with a typical Rails approach. And if you use this new Rails databases separation, you can have multiple databases. You can do it as long as you're fine with the lack of transactions. That's good.
Right. And we've gone through a lot. That's a lot of information to suck in. But now, can you discuss some advanced event sourcing concepts in the context of Rails, such as snapshotting and projections and the implications for application performance?
Yeah, I will just first refer to your comment about, you know, that this is a lot of information if to our listeners and or watchers. It's okay. I know I'm trying to do my best to explain this, but you know, it took me years to really get it, and then try it on a sandbox project, and then on the end I tried it in a production project. Now we all our production projects use these approaches. Back to your main question about advanced event sourcing. I would even add the third topic, which is even also quite interesting, because yes, snapshotting is interesting, projection is interesting, but versioning is a very difficult concept in event sourcing. So versioning of events. With snapshots, I would answer easily, don't go there. That's why domain-driven design helps us splitting the objects into smaller, so that their streams of events are smaller, so that you don't need to solve performance issues with tools like snapshots. But okay, there are some people, smart people, who also say snapshots are fine. Snapshots is, what is snapshotting? Snapshotting, it means that if you have, let's say, a design which went badly and it ended up with your object having 5,000 events, or let's say 50,000 events. I don't know how crazy the design would need to be, but okay, someone, let's say, did it wrong and it ends up with this huge stream of events. But even now, Ruby is super fast, so Ruby can consume such events really fast now with all the speed improvements with Ruby 3. But okay, there is at some level even database issue, right, with, let's say, grabbing 50,000 of records. So what you do in this way is you are sometimes adding a new kind of event to your stream, which is basically a persistent snapshot of all your data in this object. So it's very similar, like we can see active records right now, like a row of data. So sometimes you will have an event which represents like a row of data, all the state in this moment, which then means that when you load this, let's say it's an order object, you don't need to replay all the events before the snapshot. You're only interested in the snapshot event. So you are kind of resetting the state to the snapshot data. And then you apply the newer events, the small newer events. So let's say there was 50 of them. So as you can see, this is a performance technique. So you don't need to load all the small hundreds or thousands of events. You just use the snapshots technique. But again, snapshots show that something was wrong with your design. It's normally not a typical situation. It's only a rescue situation. So that's about snapshotting. Projection is a way of retrieving your data from, retrieving your events from your event store or your events table, where you just want to say, hey, I'm interested in user name changed, user login changed, and user password changed, because I really want all the authentication data to be projected, right? So you are defining what kind of events you are interested in, and you are mapping this to some view. So it's a very similar concept as in database views, let's say. So database view is an abstract concept, doesn't physically exist in a table. It's just a mapping of certain tables together, for example, to show you the data. So that's a very similar thing with events. You just project them into some data structure. So from events, you get some data. So that's projection. And yes, for us, event versioning is a concept that we need to somehow help you handle, so that for you, you don't need to read a whole book about it. And again, event versioning is a situation where you design some events, and many people actually fall into this trap at the beginning that their events will be very big. Very similar problem, like with big user class, you will have, let's say, user changed event, and then you will have all the new data, not only the new data that really changed, because then, okay, maybe it makes sense, but all the existing data in the user, all the 50 columns, will be mapped to a new event. And then it's a problem, actually, because similarly as a user class consisting of everything, it introduces coupling, which is a risk that you will, you know, break your system because you change one part and another part depends on it. This is the issue with big events. So sometimes, of course, if you do events badly, you will have the same problem as with active record big classes. So it doesn't solve the problems magically if you just create huge events right now. But so with events, maybe you want to change the in the next version. You don't want to publish 50 attributes because you know you want to have better control. We want to have more granular events. But okay, you still need to live with user changed event because there are many read models who consume it. Read models who are interested in displaying the user data. But then after some detection, you will see, okay, but this is new user. The consumers of the user changed event, they actually are interested only altogether in 10 attributes. They are not interested in all 50 attributes. So you want to maybe introduce a user changed event version 2. And this version need to be introduced somehow. And just not to get you too much into all the details, this is solved by changing all your existing code to only use the user changed version 2 event. So you don't have this in your code, any kind of reference to user changed version 1. But of course, in the database, you still have old events. You have user store, user changed event in the first version, in the first schema. So what you want to do is you want to upcast. And upcasting is a process of taking the old event one by one, while retrieving, usually. You can make it at one time, but usually you don't want to change your history. That's a really important part of event sourcing and a big feature of events, that you always have a whole history of changes. So you don't want to change your existing events in your database. So if user changed in version 1 consisted of 50 attributes, let them live in the database like this. But when you retrieve them from the database, you do that upcasting at the event store level. We can do this. And we will just delete all the unnecessary attributes from version 1. So we will just remap it to the user changed version 2 And that's, of course, an easy upcasting change because we just delete it. Deleting is easy. But whatever logic you have that you maybe one field becomes in a meaning different now. So you've had a client ID, which used to be, let's say, a database ID, but now it becomes UID for some reason. Then the upcasting would actually run some logic. So you have to implement this logic of upcasting. So you will convert on the fly from the old version of this event, which used database ID, to the new version, which uses UID, so that all the new code base doesn't have to deal with the old data. And it's actually very convenient way of working because you can introduce new versions, create upcasters, and then in the code, you don't have to deal with the old stuff too much.
Right.
I'm not sure how easy it was to understand.
Yeah. It's such like all these concepts that I'm hearing you describe, like they're so foreign to me. Like I've never worked with any of them, but I've heard you a lot. I've watched some of your lectures. I've watched other people talk on the same subject. And every time I listen to it, it feels like I still don't know anything.
Okay. I understand.
Yeah, it's
very typical and
yeah. It's something that I feel if like I owned a Rails company or a Rails shop, it's something that I feel it would be very difficult for me to hire talent for. Because like I don't know anyone who knows, well, apart from you and maybe Robert, who knows anything about DDD. I think there are a few people who have read a lot about it, but I've not come across like some situations where you could apply them or change from the Rails way of doing things and then applying DDD. I know you're one of the organizers of a Ruby and Rails conference in Wrocław, Poland, which is, by the way, the city that I live in. I've been to Wrocław, RB, a few times. And I never asked this, but can you give me a short history about Wrocław, RB?
Yes, Wrocław, RB is a conference which happens in Wrocław. And by the way, from the marketing perspective, it's hard for English people to pronounce Wrocław. So Rocklaw is usually the way they pronounce it, which is a bit of a challenge for us from a branding perspective. Yeah, Wrocław RB is a Ruby conference which started 12 years ago in Wrocław, which was kind of like a natural consequence of having a very active Ruby community in Wrocław. So the Ruby community started the Wrocław Ruby User Group or Dolnośląski Ruby User Group. And the drug meetups, they started in 2006 or 2007, I don't remember exactly, so quite early. And there was a very engaged community, very, passionate people about Ruby. We very quickly became like, each of us came to Ruby from different sides. I was a Java developer before, so I switched. There were some people who were in Python, but they switched, and there are some people who just started and they were using Ruby as their first language. So we connected together. We started running this, monthly meetups. Very quickly, they became actually bi-monthly because we introduced another meetup which was also Ruby related. Then we also had Ruby camps, drug camps somewhere in the mountains, in Polish mountains usually. So there was a very active community, and this community was also targeting more, let's say, advanced concepts. So actually this event sourcing topic was discussed very early on in our meetups, maybe not exactly in 2007, but maybe in 2010, it was already a topic which appeared. So we came up with this idea that, okay, let's extend our community, let's invite people from other places, and let's create this conference, which would be in this way different, that we will not be afraid to touch difficult concepts. And we will not be afraid to touch concepts from other programming communities. So there was a joke even that we are the best Java conference in the Ruby community because we borrowed some ideas from the Java community. Domain-driven design was more popular in Java and .NET communities than in Ruby. So we decided, okay, let's make this conference and let's target more advanced topics. And this year we will organize 11th edition. There was a break in the COVID year, and 2021 was also break. 2022, we came back. 2023, we've had another edition. And now we are working on the April edition in 2024. So the history was like this, and it's still kind of the same. So there is a active Ruby community in Wrocław. There were some editions and still are actually now. We also have people from other Ruby cities in Poland. And even like there was a moment where Ukrainians friends were helping us from the Lviv Ruby community. So there were it was kind of like uniting many Ruby people together to organize something nice. And in Poland, in the history of the Ruby conferences, there were many conferences, but I believe we now remained as one of the oldest one, and probably in Europe, apart from, of course, Euroco, which is quite legendary. There are not so many conferences which were run for over 10 years. So I'm glad that we maintain this tradition and the spirit remained the same. So we meet for 3 days in Wrocław, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. This year is 12, 14 April. We will have 12 talks, 2 discussion panels, workshops, lightning talks. And all of this is kind of targeting more like, let's say, senior people, mid/senior people in the community. So some or very ambitious juniors, of course, they will find themselves as well. We don't focus on, let's say, famous speakers, more about important and deep topics. Very often with some trends, like, for example, this year we will have... he's called Morgan. Sorry, I don't remember his name, but he's kind of creating this trend, very interesting, which we're also kind of experimenting with a little bit about SQLite. About bringing
Morgan.
SQLite. So he kind of tries to make this SQLite database kind of production ready for Rails project. So this is one of the talks I'm looking forward to the most this year. There will be the creator of WebMock, Bartosz Blimke. WebMock is a very famous library, but very silent person behind it, who never was in public really. Who is my friend? Bartek is my good friend, and it's amazing. I convinced him to go on stage, and he will talk about the story behind WebMock, but also about how it is actually built. What is the structure behind? And WebMock, apart from RSpec, is probably one of the most famous libraries. I see this in almost every project I open. So, and there was for many years one person basically behind it. Of course, there were some contributors later, but he was a very silent person. Now lives in Warsaw. So that's another topic. So you can see the spirit. We try to dig deep into some topics, and we're not afraid of experimenting with new ideas. So of course we are more than happy with Rails oriented topics. But we are also very open to, let's say, maybe not controversial, but for example, challenging ideas. Like, okay, it's okay to go to the stage and say, hey, the Rails way with Active Record maybe is not the best idea for big projects, right? So, and then explaining why I did this. So, so I think that's the spirit of our conference, and I'm happy that many people come from different parts of the world, but of course it's definitely more popular here in the Central and East Europe.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask, how is Wrocław RB different from the other mainstream conferences that you know of?
Yeah, I visited many conferences. I was attending many Euroco editions. There was Eurocamp in Germany some years ago. I think how we differ, but I don't want to now generalize because there are many differences. Like, for example, I never was at Brighton Ruby in UK. Probably they're also quite advanced. I'm very happy that we have really a big, diverse number of conferences, which are diverse in the level of topics and which groups they target. We definitely position ourselves as more the advanced topics. So if you're interested in more advanced, more deeper ideas, maybe even some ideas that challenge the status quo in the community, then you will find it here amazing. For example, for people who are very happy with the Rails way of doing things, who are happy with this CRUD approach, nothing wrong with this, But maybe it's not a great conference for them because, okay, it would be like too many weird ideas being presented, like why to go CQLite if you have Postgres and so on. So I think it's we are this way different, that we target some unusual things. We try to inspire, we try to educate, we try to entertain a little bit, but it's mostly about going deep. So we usually don't have soft talks too much, soft topics or soft skills. It's the whole agenda is created with very deep technical stuff. We've had Michael Feathers in the past. We've had some big names too, which, you know, when they talked about some deeper topics.
All right. And how does your CFP process look like? Like, what do you look out for? How do you pick your talks?
We are publishing the concept of call for papers very early on. We try to, you know, marketing around it wherever possible. We reach to certain people that we know that they might have some interesting talk proposals. The main evaluation is about what I just explained. So we try to find some new interesting trends which would be presented in a very deep level. So we always try to talk to the speakers. Okay, you know, we choose you, but you know, keep in mind that we detect in the description if it can be a little bit deeper than usual, right? So if we see a talk, very often we actually choose because we are kind of not caring that much about who exactly is a speaker. We don't check based on names. We check based on the deepness. So actually very often we have first-time speakers at our conference. So we have first-time speakers who talk about very deep stuff. So let's say Bartosz Blimke with WebMock. This will be like such an a situation. I think his last public talk was 15 years ago. So you could call him even almost like a first-time speaker. And yes, it's exactly the topic that when we detected it's possible to have such talk, we wanted this. And all the other talks we discuss internally, you know, based mostly about those metric of, you know, how deep is it. And really, we don't check based on the speaker skills that much. So if someone wants to talk next edition, now we have the whole agenda ready. If you want to talk, speak next year, don't worry about it. I think our audience is very like forgiving in terms of speaking skills. So we are not here to judge you for your public speaking skills. But if you present an interesting and deep topic, what you did, and it contains your presentation contains code, that's also a kind of like a almost requirement, and then it's a good fit our conference.
Right. And when is your CFP open, and what's the closing date for your CFPs?
So this year we changed our date from September, that was previous two editions. We changed it to April, so we are recording this in March. Maybe someone still has a chance to attend, so if you still have time, I invite you. I think you will not regret coming as a participant. But when it comes to call for papers, I think we opened it in January, and I think we closed it somewhere in February, late February, so usually it's running over like 2 months.
I missed that.
So for this year, sorry?
I missed that. I missed the CFP open and closing dates.
Yeah, so we are not the best sometimes at marketing, so or at promotion. So I'm very sorry if you missed it and you wanted to submit something.
And I think probably one of the reasons I missed the whole thing is I'm used to Wrocław RB being somewhere around September. And then last I checked, it was going to be in April. I was like, wait, what's going on here? So I missed everything. I didn't know about all of these things. But it's
fine. I'll be happy to quickly explain this, because actually every year in the past, we were March conference. We always were in March. So we were always, because that was usually the beginning of the season of conferences, and we wanted to be first. In 2010, I think we were the first conference in this part of Europe, at least. And all went fine. There was always March. Always, it was always this kind of winterish / early spring. Usually the weather sucked. Sometimes there was snow at the conference. But when COVID happened, we had to cancel 2020 edition almost days before it happened because it was March. And then we wanted to do 21, but they introduced lockdowns in March. And then for 22, again, we were thinking about March and there was again lockdown, or at least there was a risk of lockdowns in March. So we said, okay, because we didn't know how long it will take with this epidemic, you know, problems. So we said, okay, we really want this conference to happen in 2022. Let's do September. So September in 2022 was an exception, which was carried on to 2023. But now actually we kind of come back to March. So we assume, okay, hopefully no COVID problems anymore, no lockdowns. So let's go back to, okay, it wasn't exactly March because it's April, but let's say this part of the year. And we will try to stick to this. I think we will stick to March/April. So I hope, I really understand that this is important, let's say, public interface, that, you know, what is the time of the year that we publish. So I'm very sorry for the confusion here. We've had to adjust after COVID. Now we are readjusting back. So that's the story here.
Yeah, I think the pandemic missed a lot of stuff, like if you're talking about conferences and meetups around the world. So it's something that we got used to, and then things changed, and now we sort of like we have to readjust our plans and schedules, and yeah, that's all fine. But before I leave you, I still have questions about event sourcing. I needed time to process everything that you told me. So I have like, I don't know, two or so more questions. Let's finish that and then we're done for today. And what are the key design patterns and Rails libraries that facilitate the implementation of an event-driven architecture? And how do they compare in terms of performance and scalability and ease of integration into existing Rails applications?
Okay, that's a very good question. How to answer this? So first of all, there are not so many event store libraries in the Ruby community, but of course there are some. We are the people, I mean, we as Arkansy, we're the people behind Rails Event Store. So that's the name of this library, railseventstore.org. You can check the documentation. And that's even from the name, we try to send the message, hey, we are very friendly towards Rails applications. We are targeting Rails applications. We want to help you with your Rails applications. So that's our message is clear. And by the way, the initial version of Rails Event Store was an extraction from a client project. We help our clients with projects. And it was an extraction. And we started with this, I think, in 2015, so quite a long time ago already. I'm not sure if there was something else. I can say that there is a whole ecosystem also behind a library called Eventide. Eventide, they started with a bit different perspective. Then they shifted, and we often invite them to Wrocław RB, and there was actually even you can watch on YouTube and the previous all our talks are on YouTube for free. There was a discussion panel last year, so in September, where there was me on the panel, Pavel, who is the main developer right now behind Rails Event Store, and there was two guys from Eventide. They came, they had a flight to from the US actually. And we had a, you know, interesting discussion, debate. Of course, there were some puns between us. You know, we are kind of competing, but we are friends. I think we serve the same idea, just in different ways, because they are more focused on combining. However, they don't force it, but they started with more about allowing microservices and they integrated via database. They used some features of Postgres, which allow you to PubSub using Postgres. So they allowed you to have microservices, which will have one, which will share the database. I think they still follow this path. I don't want to like misrepresent what they do. That's my understanding of their history of their evolution. And we actually even helped each other a little bit with our implementations. So it's nice to share the ideas. So I think they only later switched or shifted towards making it easier and more friendly to use with Rails. And I believe we try to be, our main message from Rails Event Store is that we want to be the best for Rails projects. We But under the hood, Rails Event Store is just like a very small umbrella of Ruby Event Store. Rails Event Store is a better marketing name. Under the hood, there is Ruby Event Store, which has no Rails dependency. So you can use it in actually we wanted to have a Hanami application, and there is no reason not to have this. It's just someone could just help us from Hanami, let's say, to implement this. It should be very straightforward. So, and there's a number of, I think, there were other, I think Whisper was another like PubSub library. I'm not exactly sure how they work. There was Sequent or something like this, which kind of sounded like CQRS. So there were other approaches, but I think usually there was one person behind it. So maybe they didn't, there was not enough, let's say, resources to maintain it or to marketing this. So as Rails Event Store, there is a real, you know, big company called Arkansy behind it. We want people to trust it because, you know, Arkansy exists since 2007. So you can use Rails Event Store and count on this, that this works and that it will be maintained. And we will introduce new versions and so on. So because we serve as Arkansy, we are a consulting agency. So we serve our clients with big Rails projects. This is really serious stuff, right? It's a big, big traffic, big data, big money projects. So Rails Event Store is like a free tool you can use from our company, but we can also help you with introducing this. But there's no idea or lock-ins. We don't want to force you to use Rails Event Store. I actually think it wouldn't be so difficult to switch between Rails Event Store and Eventide, let's say, or any other one, because it more depends on you as a programmer, how much you will couple your code to the actual implementation. You can have your own Event Store object, which will delegate to the Rails Event Store client object, which is the facade, and then you can always like switch if you want to some other library. So I'm sorry, I'm not super familiar with the ecosystem that much, because I don't think the ecosystem is so big. I think the to me, the choices would be between Rails Event Store and Eventide probably. And we have different philosophies. Eventide, they also built a number of small libraries around it. They will encourage you to use it, which are interesting, but we don't have this philosophy, let's say. We just say, hey, we will use whatever you have with Rails. We just want to be as friendly to Rails as possible, because that's our philosophy. We really believe that Ruby on Rails is amazing framework. It's amazing and easy to start with Ruby on Rails. It's amazing and easy to, you know, do the development in the first months using this typical active record approach. We just believe that there is a moment in time in a life cycle of a project where active record might not be enough. This is our belief, and this is our kind of a mission that we want to spread, that, hey, maybe following this too far for two big projects, you know, there is a limit to this. And when you see the limit, then you may want to consider Rails Event Store with this, you know, domain-driven design approach and so on. And by the way, you also mentioned before that, you know, you don't see people, that it sounds risky to introduce it. It's a really fair comment. I agree with this. It's just when the challenge is about, you know, maintaining or rescuing a really big, really, and also making a big money application and consisting of, let's say, 200 active record models, then anyway, juniors or typical Rails people will not be able to help that much. You need some brave decisions. And we never introduce revolutions. Introducing events is one by one. We just, let's say, new service object, we will suggest publishing an event. That was, let's say, user registration service object. Let's publish a user registered event. At the beginning, it's almost like an audit log. You just use events to, let's say, build an audit log. And it can be very gradually introduced. You don't need to all have this old idea of bounded context. You don't need to even understand them at the beginning. You don't need process managers. You can just start by publishing events, and you don't even need to like subscribe to them if you want to get used to the idea of events. If you want to understand like how it can look in practice in a bigger application, then once again, this Arkansy e-commerce project, and this on GitHub under Rails Event Store organization, there is e-commerce project where you can clone easily and run and see how all the code is nicely modularized. And you can detect whether it's for you or totally not. But if your application consists of, let's say, 5, 10, 15 active records, then probably your application is too small to really benefit it. At the same time, somewhere you need to start learning if something here sounded interesting. No, just use one of your side projects. I don't recommend starting with events on your client or your real product where, you know, it's a big risk if you don't know what you're doing. Okay, it's as long as you are just publishing events, you are not breaking things. It's similar to just adding a log statement.
Yeah. How can event sourcing be effectively integrated with Rails's active record model, given that Rails is heavily oriented towards state-based persistence rather than event-based?
Yeah. Step by step, you can do this. That let's say you have service objects for each of the change that happens to your, let's say, user object. Let's say there is 6 such service objects. So you're introducing the user registration service object. You add a new event at the end of the service object. You just call event store publish user registered event. So you create a user registered class, and it's very very small class. You inherit from Rails event store event. And you publish this event, and then you maybe user profile changed. You find the service object responsible for changing the user profile data, and then you publish this event there. So there is nothing about persistence yet. It's only about publishing. But publishing in our Rails event store means it will be persisted. The event will be persisted. And once you get to the point that all your 6 service objects are publishing probably 6 different events, then at least for the new data that is coming out of your system, your user is fully now can be built from events. So you can now make this decision, but you don't have to, that maybe you will now retrieve the user. By the way, if you have a concept, an abstraction of repository, which returns you the active record classes, then you just change to one place because you, let's say you have load, user load somewhere in this repository, you will just change it to, you know, grab the events, grab the stream of events and use it. So you're publishing the events into the same stream. Now you have all the data covered. Of course, you need to decide what you do with the old data. You can either choose to load them via active record with the old way, and for all the new ones, you will just build them from events. So you will replay the events, but you don't do it manually. With Rails Event Store, you get helpers and such objects for everything. That is typical. So loading events from a stream is a very typical operation. So then you decide, and now you're switching. Okay, so now you're loading data. So along the way, introducing the concept of a repository object is still a good idea. Even you don't end up loading your objects from events, I think it's a very useful abstraction, especially in bigger projects, that you want to have one place where you load your object from the database to memory. It's nice to have one place for this. So if you have one place and now all your 6 service objects are using this repo abstraction, then you just change one place, and for all the other places it's transparent. Of course, your project depends on the idea that your user is an active record class, not only with the idea that it's persisted. But active record is a huge number of things. It's like the old active model. It's about being, you know, used in the views. So it's safest to first actually still use active record instance once it's loaded to memory. And only then you have to, and by the way, that's why the split into reads and writes becomes important, because in very small steps, you will reduce your dependency to active record in your views. You will reduce the dependency on active record in your business logic. And it's a number of small steps, but in a disciplined way, you will end in a situation that you will have, you know, read models, you will have the domain-driven objects and event-sourced objects, and it will be easier. Because what is Rails about? Rails is about active record. What is active record? Active record is a huge interface of hundreds of methods. So by inheriting from active record, you are exposing a huge number of methods. This is exactly... this is the definition of active record. We try to combine the best of objects and the data. But in a big project, you want to have your objects under certain discipline. You don't want to expose all the data in so many different ways. You don't want to expose all the update methods that active record has. It's amazingly handy when the project is small. But later you want to have a discipline. You don't want to risk that you are just passing this object somewhere and someone calls user.destroy or user.update attributes. You don't want this. There are certain areas where you want to have control what is happening. So you do this by, you know, slowly reducing your dependency on the different Active Record features and replacing them with other building blocks like read models, like event sourcing, event source aggregates, and so on. Sorry, that was a long answer, but I hope I showed the steps, you know, how they can be introduced.
Yeah,
it's a very disciplined process.
It involves like deep knowledge to feel comfortable around this. I mean, like you cannot just get up one day and say, "Hey, I'm going to make my project DDD or event driven or add event sourcing." This needs a deeper level of understanding that meets the eye. But I want to thank you very much for joining the show. It's been fun having you on the show, and thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Emmanuel, and I hope to see you at the conference, and I hope to see other watchers, listeners of this show. And you're doing an amazing job in the Rails community, so thank you for this as well.